I thought our last session was very interesting. It gave a lot of interesting points to stimulate our creativity. I woke up and I had lost my voice. And by drinking a lot of honey, I've got a little bit back, but I don't usually sound like a frog. So our session is really quite free, and it's to explore, and in some ways confrontational ways, of why, how we can be more innovative, especially a dinosaur like me, how the ideas I can learn and try to implement. So I want to really introduce the panelists. Al Mershon was given a long introduction. He just spoke, so I'm not going to really go in, but he's the managing partner at Myriad Marketing USA, and he's focused on creating strategic marketing solutions for clients' challenges. Heather Hardwick Rhodes is the CEO and co-founder of Travel Styles, a market research and strategy consulting firm that serves the travel and tourism industry exclusively. She gave the initial bold talk. It had very interesting data, and I took notes if no one else attended. We have also Emily Kasperson, who's representing the affinity groups, the travel planners. She's senior manager for Stanford University's legendary travel study program. She joined Stanford Travel Study in 2000, which is very hard to believe looking at her. And she's a senior manager since 2013. She's been adventuring for 15 years, which includes over 50 voyages. We also have, representing the tour operators, Carl Shepard, the founder of Insider Expeditions, who is proud to have developed and delivered over 500 customized educational travel programs. You got a lot to do to catch up with me, I can tell you. He started off with enrichment travel in South America. He worked in Japan on the Peace Boat. He speaks fluent Spanish and Japanese. It's a very interesting career here. So without further ado, I think one of the questions is, for me, I've always led tours, I've designed tours with faculty and curators of museums, which are tied into a specific departure date. But one of the interesting things that Al, and I think Heather probably can back up, is that the departure date is the number one determining factor. So when you do what I do, which is to schedule one departure with a distinguished expert, I just got calls yesterday. I heard that, oh, we can't make that date. When's the next one? Well, it's not till next year. And we don't have the confirmed date yet. So what's happened is we have a trend going on where people are exploring in the travel planner market private departures. National Geo has private expeditions. You call them private. What does Stanford call them? Private editions. There's TaylorMade, Smithsonian. I've come up with one trip, I'm calling it private departure, and we list all these different dates. Well, basically, you can choose any date you want. But it's not scholarly focused, so there's a lot of blowback because you can't just snap your fingers. So I would be curious how our panelists might address the fact that we have, unless you're like National Geographic, the world's largest magazine, you can do 20 departures of the same trip. Most of us do one departure per year of this particular trip. How do we address the problem of private departures being number one determinant, yet we are fixed in our faculty curator driven trips?
There we are. I think that's a really interesting question, Todd, and Stanford has been, as you called out, we've been having our private editions programs for the last few years. It's something that, really started out with a well-known alum who wanted to bring a bunch of friends on a cruise, and so they reached out to us because they know Stanford Travel Study is well respected and has connections, and they wanted to take advantage of that. And so that was kind of the starting point. I think, you know, so a lot of people will come off to us and they'll say, oh, I'm celebrating a special occasion. You know, would you be able to set up a trip for my family to go to Ireland where, you know, that's a kind of a family heritage trip. We want to go back with all of our, you know, children and grandchildren. Or there's a small group that wants to go to Africa. So they'll call us and ask us to do that. So those are those kind of things that come out of different places and word of mouth. But there are people who will want to go on our trip of ours to the Galapagos with their family, and there's not enough space on the trip, and we'll say, you know what, we can do that for you. You know, if you want to go this year, we'll set up the trip for you to go to the Galapagos with your family. It'll be a little bit smaller, and we'll work with them to develop that. Or if we have, you know, if somebody says, oh, gosh, I really want to go on that Galapagos trip, but those dates don't work for me, we can do the same thing. So that's how we've kind of set ourselves up to take advantage of that.
Is anyone here else in the travel planners working on private departures? Princeton is? On an ad hoc basis, similar to what Emily just said. Project a little more, please. Great, and that's Bridget from Princeton Journeys.
I mean, I would just quickly add, you know, it isn't just ad hoc for us anymore. I mean, we have a very, you know, it's committed program that has a campaign, so we're getting the word out to let people know this is something you want to take advantage of with Stanford.
That is why you're a legend.
I'm from the non-legend. one of my mentors always taught me, you know, he said, Al, remember, in business, there's no problems in business, only expenses. And I think that even falls under this category, too. If people want to do something and they want a professor, there's always a cost that goes with it, which means there's also an opportunity. One of the things that we're seeing across the board in travel is the booking habits have changed, where people used to book 9 months to a year ahead for international travel. It's changed to either 6 weeks out or 16 months out. And that's been a big dramatic shift. And a lot of tour companies and cruise lines and everybody else are now putting their 2020 material out now and saying it's exclusive. If you want this, you have to book now. So I think getting way ahead of the game with some of this helps get people on the trips you want them on, or allows you to make
however
money.
It's difficult to confirm a faculty leader, you know, 8 months prior, let alone for 2 years. They'll say, well, we don't know about that conference in Copenhagen, etc. I'll give you one idea which I think could work for some private departures. It's sort of just dawning on me. This is a very creative session, and Al has really spurred those juices. Almost every, and this is really for universities and colleges, you have extensive overseas student programs which last a full semester. And I think there would be creative ways to allow people to choose during that semester to go, and there would be faculty from your school who would be available then, not full time, but and then you'd interface with the students. That's a thought. Anyone else on this subject? Heather.
I think I was thrown when you said that you think that maybe the single departure date is the issue here. I would actually argue that this is sort of a reactionary way to get at this, but what we were going to be talking about was the escalating competition. I mean, the vast majority of U.S. outbound travelers, which we study, and the vast majority of your potential travelers, people who say they're in the market for an affinity educational tour or would be likely to do that, don't generally travel with a group. And in fact, the growth area that we've seen over the longest term has been in custom travel, which is effectively private, customized itineraries, semi-independent. It might be, you know, organized by someone, but the vast majority of your travelers are not traveling with a group on any given trip. In fact, on their most recent trip, the affinity travelers that we have within our database, only 1 in 10 of them took an escorted group tour. So if you're dedicated to group travel, that means you're missing 90% of your market on any given trip. They may love your product, but 30 or 40% of them are traveling custom. Another 20% of them were traveling on a cruise. They make different choices for different trips. And so what we see in the marketplace as a whole and what our traditional tour operator clients are responding to is giving some element of customization within group itineraries. And they may well be selling effectively group itineraries to small groups, basically, that are self-formed and creating a departure for that. So I'm just approaching this from a different... I think what's happening, and it's been happening for a long time here because I've been here and people have tried to launch independent programs and there are a lot of problems with that. And I'm actually very pleased to report that we're also seeing a bounce in group travel, in preference for group travel, in actually adopting and taking group trips for the first time in like 20 years. And so there's a lot going on, but I think that some of what Stanford has picked up on, they may have come to it by the fact that someone has requested something and you're like, oh, we can't help you. But I think it's also, it's either aligning with, it may be driven by, it may be in response to market forces. And I think that it demands to be looked at by others if you have the wherewithal and, you know, some way to speak to those preferences.
I can't agree more. I would say I was at least 25 years ago at one of the earlier conferences. I remember saying, what is our biggest competition? It's that people don't want to travel in groups, especially younger travelers. They think it's, you know, a bus tour and they're off, you know. I remember speaking to one of my buddies from the university and he's like, I'm not going to go on a safari in a group. And I'm like, a safari? What are you walking across the Serengeti by yourself with your tent? But anyway, this is really the point. I think, though, we are in the affinity travel business. So how do we create group experiences? That's our goal, is to build a relationship with our organizations. To be a really sophisticated travel agency, which is what independent travel requires, would be impossible, I think, for the vast majority who do not have an extensive travel office staff. So, Heather, do you have other points too?
I do. Yes, I mean, the good news, as I said, is we're also actually seeing group travel grow. So I work with like the Globuses and Taux and Colettes of the world who have been, cruise lines have basically been eating their lunch for 20 or 30 years now, and we're finally just now seeing that the popularity of cruising starting to taper off, but at such a ridiculously high level that it sort of doesn't even matter, and group travel sort of soaring along the bottom and hopefully sort of bouncing up. And one of the good things we actually see is not only experience with group tours increasing, but also the preference for traveling with a group, the amenability to it, and I think that's something that's really important. And Carl has an example of what he's been doing to speak to the younger generations, and we actually see within the educational travel market, so within what we've defined as affinity travelers, which if you've been to one of my talks here earlier, that's outbound pleasure travelers, so people who actually leave the country to travel for pleasure, are a member of a nonprofit group, and say that they're extremely or very likely to take a trip sponsored by an affinity group. 70 or 80% of them, basically, are amenable to the idea of traveling with a group. Only about a third of them would say that in any given day that would be their preference. So what we have to do is address some of the barriers that, for example, Joe Small and I spoke about yesterday. There's barriers to travel, and there's all the geopolitical everything going on in the world and the chaos that we're dealing with, which we track, and then there's barriers to group travel. There's the bus, there's the groups of people, you know, the like-minded travelers that used to be your affinity core. For some of these younger travelers, they're the problem, you know. Are they going to be annoying? Are they going to be old? Are they going to hold me back? The fear that there won't be freedom, we spoke about this yesterday, that there won't be any independence, there won't be any choice, that you'll be stuck on the bus, you'll be herded around with all of these travelers. And so we know, if you're selling group travel, and that's just bar none, but the people desire independent travel, but they're amenable to the idea of group travel, and they're specifically amenable to it with your affinity group, that's your hook, then the idea is we don't need wholesale change. You don't necessarily need to be doing what Stanford's doing, but there are innovations and tweaks that can be made within the bounds of basic group travel operations and products to give travelers choice. to give them some more independence, to give them freedom. And what do we find? We find that older travelers want these things too. This is not, some of it's being driven by the younger travelers accommodating a larger portion of the market. But I mean, who do you think your current customers are? They're the boomers, they're the parents of the millennials. So it's, the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. So what goes in terms of their preferences, in terms of their interests, they're interested in shorter trips. They're interested in more active outdoor activities, or at least be given the choice to do that. They may not choose it, but there are ways that you can massage and tweak and innovate within the bounds of group product, I think, to speak to some of the changes we're seeing and to take that amenability to group travel and really actually sell it if that's what you've got to sell.
I can't agree more. One of the trips which we're working on right now is offering four options. You have a free day, and you can either go on a completely escorted with a distinguished scholar to Tivoli and Hadrian's Villa, World Heritage Sites outside of Rome, or you can go market shopping, then prepare the food with the chef and cook for a half day. Then one evening, there's a wine tasting with dinner, which is an option. Many people don't drink now. So there are ways to do stuff like that. Also, and include, you can do a hike down on the Sorrento Peninsula. So you can build a program with these, and it really gives people, like, wow, I'm building my own trip. And, of course, there are optional extended stays pre and post. Would you like to add something?
Just on a few of these points, I think that on the first one, it was with Stanford being open to having those individual requests. I think the more that everyone, I think, as a whole can be flexible, that the entire calendar does not need to be baked always until, like, for the next 2 years. Maybe most of it, maybe 80%, but there are a lot of opportunities that come up, not just if someone can't go on a single departure, but maybe they just came back from the Galapagos and they were like, wow, like, can you take my family to Machu Picchu or wherever it is? And you may not be offering it, but if your program is open to be like, yes, actually we can, like, we know how to do that and we can take your whole family to Machu Picchu, you will keep them coming back. In terms of the younger groups as well, I think that, you know, there's a lot of debate, are they traveling, are they not traveling? We have certainly seen with, you know, shorter programs and more accessible price points, a big uptick in the last couple years of people selling out affinity trips, you know, 6 months in advance with a single email. And it continues to surprise us. We think it's growing. And those are also in the same category of things that they're hard to kind of plan 2 years out. And, you know, I get that is not the core business of all of us in this room, but it is the future. And they are traveling with affinity groups. And, you know, in terms of the future of all of the programs, this is the best way to get them in now if you can offer some of those offerings. I mean, my favorite example from last year, is anybody here offering a four-day trip to Morocco? Anybody? Right, who would do that, right? That's crazy. Who's going to do that? So last year, in a single email in 24 hours, we worked with a partner that sold out a four-day trip to Morocco. Now, it was targeted towards young alums. And you're thinking, well, what alums were that? Who were they? They're your alums. They're all of your alums, and they couldn't go with their universities because that wasn't offered to them. So they went with a membership organization that caters to a broad base of young professionals. So there are a lot of other groups out there that aren't here, that aren't tied to a specific university, but they're taking your travelers on trips. And I think the more that we can be open and flexible to giving them those kinds of gateway opportunities so that they can learn about, you know, your programs in the long term is great.
That's great. Any other panelists want to add to that?
One other thing. I think you need to look at your own business model too, because that is a different way of doing business. And what are the implications on that business model? We've seen a lot of big tour operators who decide to offer FITs and fail miserably at it because they're used to off-the-shelf product and they can't do that specialization and all that. So that's a decision that every company has to make. And just to echo what you were saying, we're seeing just socially this pendulum swing of everybody wanting to be independent and be on their own and text and everything else. If you look at a broader base, look at a place like WeWork, right? He's just got a market cap of I don't know how many billions. What is that saying? It's saying people actually want to get back together and talk with people and all that. WeWork is now introducing WeLive, which is a place where you can all live together because we're tired of being on our own. The next generation's tired of being on their own. So I think there's this pendulum swing that we'll see. And the other thing is I think this nebulous group travel, escorted travel, most people and we've done focus groups, they still don't know what that means.
Right.
If it means 14 people or 40 people, it's just, and every time we do a focus group, what does that mean? Nobody knows, except for one guy who was from Vietnam, whose English wasn't too good, and said, wait, you mean you get an escort with the trip? So, but that's another story.
Well, I want to build, this is supposed to be a continuing conversation, building on Al's talk just a few minutes ago. One of his key points he mentioned is do your research, ask, don't tell, conduct short surveys. I did one, a very short one, about developing a trip to sing that alumni who had taken choral classes and had been singing with a legendary choral instructor wanted to do an alumni trip. So we did a survey, because the database allowed us to go just to those people, which was considerable, close to 1,000 who had sung. And we asked very simple questions. Do you want to do Rome, Florence, and Venice? Or would you like to do Madrid, Lake Orta, Toronto, and Palenzo? Sort of the beaten path or off? 82% said off the beaten path. That was a... Now, who's doing surveys here? The travel planners, who's doing surveys? You could raise your hand a little higher. That's good. That's great. Because that's his point. Ask. It's amazing. Anyone want to add on to that?
Well, not only do surveys, but then are you doing anything with them? That's actually my big, some of our tour operator clients, they all do like exit surveys. And for the most part, it's like a 5-point scale of satisfaction. And that's just sort of useless. So we've actually worked with some of our tour operator clients to ask the right questions, which can be difficult, and frame them in the right way so that you're getting accurate, useful info. And then don't throw it in the bin. Actually utilize that information to help form your marketing and your product development. And if you're asking the right questions, you can learn quite a bit rather than scattershot whatever. And if you're a planner and you're hoping to have some influence with your vendors, you'd like them to develop product that speaks more to what you think your customers know, you have to know what they want. And so we study the whole market, but you've got these travelers in your pocket, basically, that are more than willing to tell you what they think, what they like. And so, yes, that's your best resource. Not only ask, but as we said yesterday, listen, actually.
And the trust is incredible with our organizations. That's one of the key points which a lot of retail operators don't really have. I mean, they're your alumni. They trust your school. At least they should. Anyone else want to add to that? Okay, this is an interesting one, which I'd like to delve into. And the next point, which Al mentioned, was focus more on kids. That's a tough one for me. But let's focus on what I think is focusing on the singles. Isn't that one of the biggest complaints we always get? The bloody single supplement. It's so high, and it's even worse on ships. Some of them are charging 50%, 75% more. And a lot of the VIP donor types are traveling as solo, and it really hurts. Now, I've never really scratched the numbers of thinking, well, I'll charge a little more for the doubles, and I'll get rid of the single supplement. Is anyone doing something creative in getting the single supplement either waived? I know Overseas Adventure Travel does a lot of stuff. Are they here? Well, they're already doing it, so anyway. Is anyone doing anything to try to get the singles?
I've done that a little more.
A little more, please. Project.
For the alumni trip, I actually did bump the doubles, 50, 60 a person, just to keep the single down. Because I know we have some wonderful single donors and alums who love, and they add a great deal to the trips. And so I have done that. The other thing I've done, I had a real frustration with a vendor one time because they were very restrictive with my number of singles. And I just said, can't do, because I know my people, and I know I'll have 4 or 5. And so I finally said, the only way I'll sign a contract is if I'm guaranteed. And after 5, I understand, because it's a reality. But I do think, you put that into writing.
Yes, and I had mentioned yesterday in a breakaway session, if you're blocking space on a ship, you don't just confirm the number of cabins, you confirm the number of singles and doubles. Because really, the singles are really ruling. I mean, we have a magic board. It's incredible. It's like, isn't anyone traveling with a companion and sharing? It's singles. The other thing, too, is with land programs, you really have to confirm how many singles up front. It's so much better to quickly sort of conclude the discussion. Yes, we have a single available because it said I have four single rooms. And the more remote you get, that's more of a concern you should have, is how many single rooms are on your are possible on this land trip.
So we also noticed a huge trend of solo travelers, and it is a huge hurdle for us when you have a program that you're trying to keep at about one bus size for land trip, that's, you know, maybe 32 if you're pushing it, and then you only have two singles. And, you know, our single standby list for people who have interest, you know, can be 8 to 12 to whatever. And every time a person gets added to that list, you're disappointing someone. And that for us was really difficult to do, because it's a relationship, and we didn't want people who were traveling by themselves to feel, might be a little aggressive to say discriminated against, but they're, you know, I think they felt they were denied this opportunity because of their situation. So we've been really making a huge effort to do what you were saying, is that working with our operators to try to expand the number of singles on our regular programs, which can be really challenging to do, especially on a cruise ship, but we lean in and do our best. We also then took a stab at offering some trips that were that had unlimited single space. So we kind of had trips designed for solos, is what we would call them, but basically, you know, we didn't want it to be like swinging singles trip, but we wanted to make sure that those people knew that they were going to be able to get space, no problem, and they were going to have a lot of other people who are in a similar position and feel comfortable. You know, we actually were able to take our database and find the people who had traveled as singles before and message out to them and say, we know you've traveled with us as a single. If you want to be added to the list, so you can be aware of whenever single space becomes available or when there are special trips for, you know, that has unlimited single space, you know, sign up and we'll message it out to you. So that's actually been working for us, and everything is kind of you got to keep working towards it. But building that community, making them feel that they're being attended to is great. And I think, you know, it is a new world where our operators do need to start leveraging with hotels and on the cruise ships to offer more single space, because that, you know, you're turning all those people away to these other clients.
I'll add, Emily, that one of the ways to fill a soft departure where you need those extra four or five bookings is to go through your database, pull up past single travelers, and say you're waiving the single supplement for them. That's it. But I also want to focus on another comment of Al's. That's what this meeting is largely about, and taking advantage of Heather's vast statistical analysis and data. Al said something to the effect, well, flip the equation. Why don't you have a single price and you give a discount for doubles? I'm going to mull that one over. That's an interesting way of approaching it. The reason we're doing it is because his statistic is, and Heather can back it up with others, is 45% of all Americans age 65 plus are divorced, separated, or widowed, meaning they're traveling single or else they have a new love. So focus on single prices. Then the celebration travel. This is something if you run international tours, you have the date of birth sitting right there. So to offer, and the examples given by Al were terrific, because they're going to bring others with them. I mean, they want to celebrate their birthday, so they might invite their friends. You know, I could see a whole bunch of girls going, yeah, we want to celebrate Heather's birthday, and they book. Anyone want to add?
Yes. We work in the special occasion market. So with the affinity travelers, you're already doing this. I mean, what I think Stanford's got with the private editions is, I mean, I haven't been on one, but I think it's a lot of it is families and extended families. And a lot of what we're seeing in the market in terms of intergenerational travel, you know, just happening. People are basically forming their own groups and their familial groups, family and friends groups. And that's probably the best way to get something where you can hit some sort of minimum in terms of passengers or something like that. But they're already doing this. So among the affinity travelers in our database, in our research, 1/3 report that their most recent international trip was to celebrate a special occasion. And the most popular, 1 in 7 said they were celebrating a family reunion. And among the affinity travelers, that's 2 to 3x what we're seeing among sort of the whole market. So they already equate travel, these are your most passionate travelers, they already equate travel with a gift, you know, a celebration, a coming together, a sharing of experiences. It's just, it's so obvious that they would be doing that. And then the other one is 1 in 10 are celebrating a wedding anniversary. And we track that because there's so much in the sort of general travel industry about honeymoons and destination weddings, and we track all of that. And it's like, hey, you're missing the annual recurring celebrations. The birthdays and the anniversaries are so much bigger than the one-time hit of the honeymoon. And particularly with the boomers, what we've had over time is they're hitting empty nest stage, they're hitting retirement, they're hitting the 50, 60, 70, the big time, both wedding anniversaries and birthdays, and there's just, you just replete with that, with those just like sitting right in front of you triggers that they're waiting to be invited, so to speak. And the millennials are very much into that as well. And so they're happy to celebrate 20, 30, 40. A lot of them are having kids now. They're hitting peak childbearing age. So we're creating these larger family groupings. And it's, I think it's just, it's already prevalent. And it's sort of waiting for some of the, you know, the Disneys of the world and the cruise lines and whatnot who have already leveraged this. But I think that you have a very plausible hook in that you're already an affinity. If you're a school, it's probably built into the family structure in terms of the affinity for your brand, and it's just obvious that you could offer something that is group-like with the trigger being that you know some sort of major event is coming up where they want to gather.
I just had a couple things. I'm guessing you know their graduation date.
Exactly. I was going to go there.
A guest, so that's certainly a touch point. I think just to reiterate one of the other things too, I think the other part is you get exposure to a whole nother generation, a whole nother group of people when you do this, and that's A. And B, I think it's not recession-proof, but it's recession-resistance, because you, when times are bad, well, can I travel? Well, I have a reason to travel. I have a legitimate reason. It's our 40th wedding anniversary or whatever it has. So that overcomes why I'm spending the money this time, and it just helps.
Now,
I have something to add, actually. I just want to reach out to all the travel planners out there who don't have as large of a program, and they're feeling, oh, my God, how am I ever going to set up a trip that, for a family for their 50th wedding anniversary? I mean, that it can be completely seem out of reach, and that is okay. But I think the nugget out of this could be, is there a way for you to message out to your, because I know on Stanford trips, our regular programs, there are a lot of times we have people who are celebrating a huge anniversary on our program. You know, they are choosing to travel with us. This is a huge lifetime thing for them. They have this great, you know, moment of their life that they're celebrating, but they wanted to do it with Stanford on this fantastic program. And you, your alumni bases will do that too. I mean, you know, you could just, it might be just planting the seeds. Maybe they haven't thought of it before, or you know, some, you know, don't feel like this is unattainable. I mean, there's ways for you to encourage your alums to sign up to celebrate a momentous occasion along with other travelers if they aren't, you know, if you're not able to provide a small group experience for them.
Well, to build on that, the one thing which I'm realizing now is we are usually told that they're celebrating an anniversary, but we don't capture it the way we do the birth date, because the birth date's necessary for documentation we need to compile. At least your operators are compiling that. So one thing might be to say, because you don't have to celebrate your anniversary necessarily on the same day. I mean a big one, like a silver or a gold anniversary. Say, I celebrated my 25th last year in Peru. And my son came, my nephew came, it was great. So how do we capture those? I think we could provide an incentive. If you tell us your anniversary date and then you calculate that it's their 25th or 35th, you might then be able to say, hey, celebrate and we'll give you a little discount or something like that, which is very, discounting is sort of a don't do it, but for something like that, I think it's a way you can capture that. Okay, another thing which Al talked about was layers of meaning, which I translated based on his remarks that, for example, and I think most of us are really getting into it, and certainly the operators are, there's wellness. There's some yoga classes which are offered by the resort. And, I mean, they're doing it right here this morning and yesterday morning, where you can do sort of a wellness program if you're ready, if you're not partying like me at night and ready to get up at 7. But that said, the other thing was food, food, food. It's unbelievable how distressed that. That's why an option on our scheduled faculty-driven programs is often a wine tasting with food. And I'm going to try to do sort of a beer tasting, you know, with bratwurst or whatever. Anyone address the layers of meaning and adding other components so it's not just, oh, you're with a geologist and we're looking at the volcanoes, and obviously it's not that limited, but to really add things which are not, quote, academic. Anyone? Here, you got a mic.
Oh, this is
Doug Grimes, Mir Expeditions.
I think it's on. Anyway, Doug Grimes. We started doing on some of our trips in Central Asia.
A little louder.
Sorry.
We started doing on some of our trips in Central Asia a early morning optional walk. And usually, you know, saying, okay, we're going to get up early. Started offering that, and actually, it's really taken on. I mean, and a lot of people, it's not with fancy cameras either. The ones with just phone cameras, so they want to take some Instagram pictures or whatever. And it's really something.
Well, that's great.
Yeah, just a very briefly comment. I think absolutely, and especially with wellness, and I think the way you phrase it as an optional thing in the morning, we do see that, you know, fully customized wellness trips are doing very well. A yoga retreat and these things are doing really well. I think in this particular market, I'm thinking of last year, this trip to Bhutan, where every morning there was an optional meditation, a yoga class. You could, you know, do a short hike up to a temple, and it was optional but extremely popular. And I think that everybody at any age is thinking about wellness increasingly.
Yes, we're working with a Buddhist scholar, we did a trip, and his wife is a yoga teacher, and so we offered a program to Sri Lanka. It was a lot of extra arrangements to do this. Everyone was doing yoga and meditating. And so we repeated it now, going to Bhutan, and unfortunately, his wife, the yoga teacher, is not going, for reasons I don't know. But it is optional Buddhist, and we're even scheduling it to be in the Dzongs, the fortress monasteries, with some monks. It's really going to be special, I'm sure. Don't turn it off.
I was just going to add that this kind of is feeding into what Heather was saying earlier about people wanting options and choice. And I think that, you know, optional, you know, that those are all things that they give this chance of people making the tour their own. And that is really important. Kind of interesting, different angle that we've taken for that is that we have focus programs, and they're shorter. They're in one city. And there's a lot of free time. We give people a city pass to use the public transportation. We make sure they get comfortable. We have usually a lecture in the morning and some morning activity. And then oftentimes the remainder of the afternoon is free. And then people are given suggestions for what they can do, but they have this sense of, I'm here in Berlin and I want to go to this museum that nobody else wants to go to, or, you know. And so we're trying to provide really interesting content that they wouldn't have access to on their own, and then to let them have the time to explore it as they desire. And that's actually really
Is Joe Small here of AHI? Well, they came up with, I think, a brilliant program. They do you book 5 or 6 weeks and you stay in a place. It's not that education because they only offer language classes, but talk about ultimate freedom. Has anyone done a program of that? And did it book well?
Paris Immersion was one. It was only 2 weeks, I think. But you had museum passes. They taught you how to use a subway pass. And they gave you great orientation, some walking tours, lectures, and lots of free time. And it was very
One of the trustees had taken one of those. And boy, you can just tell it's bragging rights. You know, oh, yeah, well, we're going to live like the locals for 2 or 3 weeks. You know, we're staying in one place, et cetera, et cetera. Does anyone have anything they want? Because I think Carl has a do you want to do a presentation? That's fine. We'll continue the conversation.
I wanted to just add exactly along what Emily said. The key thing that the gentleman from Mir said was, I think, was optional. And I've attended many an adventure travel summit, and adventure travel is, if we're talking about layering, it's pushed right into the mainstream, just as culinary travel, as I said yesterday, you know, as a motivation for travel, even food-related tourism appeals to the majority of your travelers, of educational travelers. So we're layering all these former niches, and it's all just sort of blending into one cohesion. But with the adventure travel, it was always surprising that, you know, like the median age of the adventure traveler was something like mid-40s, mid-50s, something like that, which seems young for this audience, but that was always surprising to people. And what it was a lot of it is actually just these older travelers want the option to be active. They may very well not do whatever it is you're offering, and that has some operational problems. But if you give them, and to yesterday's point, it's some of it's even the illusion of choice. So you may know that 90% of these people are going to go on the whatever the walking tour is, whatever the designated activity is today, but they would like to know that they were given the opportunity to do something else, yes. And then if they have some sort of problem that holds them back, as many in this market would, from doing something that might be very active, they still very much want the option to do that. So I think some of it is actually how you present it.
That's great. Rob, you have a point, a comment?
Sorry, just to close the loop here. Just one more. I think I agree with everybody. Food's still number one, but this audience wants to prepare the food. They don't just want to eat the food. So yeah, I think that's it. The options are great. I think it comes down to, if you have a variety of options, one of those options is going to be the tipping point. Well, I'm going to take this tour over this tour because they offer this or that. Mm-hmm. And one of the ones that is an interesting one to me is voluntourism, which when you ask everybody, oh, I want to do voluntourism, well, they don't, okay? they all say they do, but tell them they're going to clean elephants for 2 weeks, and you're not going to book that tour. If they're going to clean elephants for 2 hours, that could be the tipping point. They want the bragging rights of that involvement for 2 hours, and then they'll do it. The mistake we see is then you don't follow up with a relationship with the people they just did the voluntourism.
Great.
And if you can do that longer, you get a longer affinity.
Rob?
Todd, these are all exciting ideas, but I'm getting kind of a creeping discomfort. I feel like I'm on a slippery slope. I think educational travel, at least the classic model, is to have a program that represents your institution's educational mission. Now we're hearing about private edition tours. Tours with special interests that are not academic, not about the history and the culture of the destination. And I'm wondering if we're sliding toward UBIT, unrelated business income tax. Are we becoming travel agencies? As we serve the travel interests of our constituency, but we don't send lecturers or enlightened conversationalists, this is making me nervous.
Well, the point of the one private departure which I'm working on is heavily scholarly. And I think that's the big distinction you're really making. It's trips led by scholars who represent your organization. So what we've tied it into is this for the Archaeological Institute of America, which I've been directing for 18 years. We have extensive contacts at the American Academy in Rome. So there's a resource all the time. I would also add...
Yeah, I think you're worried about Stanford. I'll take it, Rob. Thank you. That's really actually a really important question. And I, you know, we don't have a lot of time up here, so it's something that I glossed over. So my apologies for causing you accelerated heart rate. But we definitely take our programs very seriously at Stanford, and we understand the educational content is extremely important. And so, you know, to work with some of these groups, we have a faculty advisor who works on the program. They give a lecture one or two before the trip. They don't always accompany them on the trip. It really depends. They provide educational materials with reading lists and books and things like that. So it's definitely not lost on us what that would look like. And so it's not, you know, when we are working with putting the program together, we're looking for a program that makes sense and it is meaningful and that has content when they're there. So it's not just going to the beach and drinking mojitos. You know, it's you're going there and you're engaging. So it's a travel study style program, but we're just tailoring it to this smaller group of people and making it work in that fashion. So it is a very good point, and I appreciate you bringing that up.
Al, yeah. You want
to? I think this whole mission versus commission question's a great one. I think there is a midline in there, but I think for a lot of businesses, our business included, we always say there's two types of projects we do, those we take to the portfolio and those we take to the bank. And sometimes you need those ones to the bank to really make the portfolio one shine.
So well, I'll back up Rob's, because I think the mission-driven ones are actually to nurture lifelong relationships with our alumni and with our members. And therefore, that is sort of a ladder of continual giving, and hopefully by the time they're in their gray whisker area, they can donate large sums and thank the institution for all their work. So that's taking it to the bank, but in the long term, I think. Yeah.
I was going to shift it a little bit and say that I think, you know, one of the things we wanted to talk about was expanding people's market share. And I think that when you're an alumni association, you only have a certain number of alums that you're reaching out to, so you're trying to connect with that group of people in different ways. And I think one of the things that Al said earlier was that there are people are traveling with their grandchildren who are no longer just 7 and 8, they're in their 20s. And so I was just going to throw out a few ideas. I know our time is running short, but I just thought this is we want people to have takeaways. But one of the things that we've been experimenting with at Stanford is we have a great family program, and we were realizing there was a whole gap of time where these people weren't traveling with us anymore because their children had aged out of our family trips, and yet they still wanted to travel as a family, and then we didn't really have an offering. They didn't want to bring them on a regular trip, so we started experimenting with programs that we call family seminars, and they're for people who have adult children. And I think that, you know, is something that we're just going to have to keep getting the word out and seeing how that will go.
Well, we're really running out of time here. So I'll suggest one thing, because I do it maybe 2-3 times a year. Go to the Stanford Alumni Travel website. Look at their product lineup. It's a very sophisticated one. My oldest colleagues and friends founded it. You can learn a lot. You learn a lot, too, if you just open up other experienced travel program websites. So this really is concluding this. So I want to thank our panelists, Carl Shepard, Emily Kaspari, Casper, excuse me, I have to look at my notes, Heather Hardwick-Rhodes, who's been 2 times bold speaker, she's really earned her keep coming here, and now Al with his sitting through his lecture, I thought it was wonderful, I've learned a lot from both of you, and thank you all, I'm Todd Nielsen, thank you. So everyone should fill out their evaluations, please. Hand them out. Thank you.
Do we have the bazaar right now?
Yes, the bazaar is starting.
I'll be over there.